He didn't think he worried about us boys that we'd ever amount to anything. And had it not been for the grace of God. I'm in 1 Samuel chapter number 25. I'm going to hop skip down through the chapter, so follow with me. I'm sure you're familiar with it, but beginning in verse number 3. Now the name of the man was Nabal. And the name of his wife was Abigail. 1 Samuel 25, verse 3, and she was a woman of good understanding and of a beautiful countenance. But the man was churlish and evil in his doings, and he was of the house of Caleb. And David heard in the wilderness that Nabal did shear his sheep. And David sent out 10 young men, and David said unto the young men, get you up to Carmel, and go to Nabal, and greet him in my name. Verse number 10, and Nabal answered David's servants and said, who is David? And who is the son of Jesse? There be many servants nowadays that break away every man from his master. Shall I then take my bread, my water, my flesh that I have killed for my shears, and give it unto men whom I know not whence they be? Verse number 15, but the men were very good unto us, and we were not hurt, neither missed we anything as long as we were conversant with them when we were in the fields. They were a wall about us both by night and day, all the while we were with them keeping the sheep. Now therefore know and consider what thou wilt do, for evil is determined against our master and against all his household, for he is such a son of Belial that a man cannot speak to him. Verse number 23. And when Abigail saw David, she hasted and lighted off the ass, and fell before David on her face, and bowed herself to the ground, and fell at his feet, and said, upon me, my Lord, upon me let this iniquity be, and let thine handmaid, I pray thee, speak in thine audience, and hear the words of thy handmaid. And let not, my Lord, I pray thee, regard this man of Belial, even Nabal, for as his name is, so is he. Nabal is his name, and folly is with him. But I, thy handmaid, saw not the young men of my Lord, whom thou didst send. Now therefore, my Lord, as the Lord liveth, and as thy soul liveth, seeing the Lord hath withholden thee from coming to shed blood, and from avenging thyself with thine own hand, now let thine enemies and they that seek evil to my Lord be as Nabal. Verse number 32, and David said to Abigail, blessed be the Lord God of Israel, which sent thee this day to meet me. And this is another reason why I know David wasn't an independent Baptist. He said to this woman, blessed be thy advice. Sometimes you can thank God for that woman's advice, Rambo. Amen. She can get smart every now and then. Independents don't believe that. I'll quit preaching. Blessed be thy advice, and blessed be thou which hath kept me this day from coming to shed blood, and from avenging myself with my own hand. Verse number 38. And it came to pass about 10 days after that the Lord smote Nabal that he died. Be seated. You know, we ought to be thankful, God being the gentleman that he is, that he only allows us a glimpse into this man's home. Aren't you glad that we don't know no more than we do? For you see, this is a cruel man's home. And God just kind of pulls back the curtain just real briefly. And he gives us a glimpse. He just lets us peek into this man's marriage, into this man's home. And then he shuttles the curtains right quick, because you and I don't need to know no more than we do. You see, he's a cruel man. He doesn't know how to treat a good woman. Nabal has a very good woman, but he does not know how to treat her. He rules his wife with such strictness, and I can only imagine the demands that he puts upon her. He robs his family of all the joy with his selfishness. Because I can imagine with Nabal, it is my way or the highway. He ruins everybody's happiness with his own stubbornness. His rudeness demands attention. And you look at such a home and you look at such a marriage and you say, could anything good come out of that? Is there any possibility that there could be any happiness at all? In the midst of all of his obnoxious rules, and in the midst of all of his strictness, in the midst of his selfishness, the unhappiness, the fighting, the fussing, the stubborn demands, there is a woman. And the Bible said she was of a good understanding. And the Bible says she had a beautiful countenance. And how this woman can maintain her sanity living with a man who is evil in his doings. How she's able to keep a countenance that is beautiful living with this man defies our imagination. If you would have seen her down at Walmart or down at the marketplace and you would have looked at her or spoke to her, you could never have imagined that there was anything wrong in her house. If you'd have spoke to her somewhere out in the public, you'd have never guessed there was anything wrong. And how she was able to maintain her mind, her mental state, her smile, her beautiful countenance. It's hard to understand, isn't it? But yet the Bible said she was a good woman with good understanding and a beautiful countenance. Somehow she was a light in darkness. If you'd have walked into that house, I imagine that was a dark house with a man that just loves to live evil. But if you'd have walked into that home, there would have been one bright spot. And it'd been Abigail. I imagine she was laughter in the midst of misery. Because you see, usually misery follows evil. Well, wherever there's evil, there's going to be a lot of misery. But if you'd have walked into this house, you'd have found a little laughter in all that misery. And how in the world she could maintain that? It's almost impossible to even imagine and get. She was life in the midst of deadness. And how she kept her sanity and how she kept her happy face in the midst of all of his evil doings, I can understand now why the Bible said she was a good woman. She was a strong woman. You have to be a strong woman to endure that kind of home. You'd have to be. She was a smart woman. For to maintain your mental state in the midst of all that evil and to keep a happy countenance and a beautiful countenance in the midst of all that evil, she had to have been smart. You're just not going to do that without being somehow knowing what you're doing. She was a strong woman. She was a smart woman. She was a survivor. Because can you imagine the burden she carried? Can you imagine what she had to endure and what she had to see and what she had to hear day after day after day? Because he was churlish, evil in his doings. She had to have been a survivor. She had to have been a very spiritual woman because she knew at least to go to the king. She is spiritual. And oh, unthankful Nabal. You know, he should have woke up every morning and been thankful to have her. You know, he should have woke up every day and just said, thank God she didn't leave me today. He should have been thankful. He might not have wanted to live like she lived. He might not have wanted to believe what she believed. He might not have wanted to act like she acted, but he ought to have been thankful that at least he had a good woman. And he should have walked out in that front yard every day and just kind of looked at whether he believed in God or not. He just should have looked up there and said, you know, I don't even know if you're there, but boy, I sure want to thank you for a good woman. Should have been thankful. He should have adored her. He really should have. Even if he didn't want to live like she lived, he should have loved her with all of his heart. He should have spent more time with her. Did you know a good woman will make a dumb man look better? It really will. You can be the dumbest cluck in Baytown. If you got a good woman, people will think you're half smart. Well, it's true. I mean, you can shout right there, Baptist. A good woman will make you look better. People actually think you're smart. And all you're doing is taking her advice. How do you know that? I'm a school teacher. He should have spent more time with her because it might have rubbed off on him. Did you know, if you go back over into the garden in the book of Genesis, it never said that the woman needed help. It says that the man needed help. Now listen to me, Rambo. She don't need you. You need her. She can do just fine without you. She can make it. And as much as you have a hard time admitting it, you can't do without her. Nabal was not only blessed to have a good woman, but Nabal was blessed with an opportunity to meet the king. You don't get to meet the king every day. You see, everybody knew that David was going to be king one day. It wasn't a secret. Everybody knew that Samuel had poured that anointing oil on him over there in chapter 8. And everybody knew that one day he was going to sit on the throne in Jerusalem. They knew that. They knew that. And yet, oh, happy day when you get to meet the king. And Nabal, you talk about the opportunity of a lifetime. He gets to meet the king. And the thing about meeting the king, a king never forgets a favor. A king never forgets a kind word. A king never forgets a deed of mercy. Never does. And Nabal now has the opportunity to do a kind deed for David that will one day pay big dividends when he has finally reached the throne in Jerusalem. For you see, David's in distress now. He's not on the throne, but he's going to be one day. And right now, he's been pushed out into the wilderness. Right now, he's been run out of town. And he needs just a little help. He doesn't ask for much, just a little bit. He's a hungry, he just needs a little bread. He just needs a little water. He just needs a little flesh. He's not asking for much, just 10% is all he's asking for. He doesn't want the whole, just a little piece. And all of a sudden now, I was hungry, and you fed me. I was thirsty. And you gave me drink. For you see, a small act of kindness for David now is going to pay big dividends later. Multiplied. You do an act of kindness, give a kind word, give a little water, give a little flesh, give a little bread. It will be multiplied again and again and again when David finally sits upon that throne. Give. And it shall be given unto you. Good measure, pressed down, shaken together, running over. What measure you measure shall be measured unto you. And Nabal now has the opportunity to do something for David that will one day pay big dividends. So what David does, David sends messengers. And he gives these messengers a faithful message. And he puts it in the hands of some faithful messengers. And when he sends these messengers to Nabal, he said, look, when y'all take this message, I don't want you to take it in your name. You take it in my name. Because I want you to tell him that I'm the one that is sending this message. Don't you go tell him what you think. Don't go tell him what you want to do. You go tell him what I said. And be sure that you tell him David said it. You make sure that you give that message in my name. And it was a very tender message for a terrible man. Look at verse 6. You want to know what message that the king sent this man that is churlish and evil and stubborn and selfish? Here's the message that he sends him in verse 6. And thus shall you say to him that liveth in prosperity, peace be both to thee and peace. Can you imagine sending a message to this man and offering him peace? That's unbelievable to think that you could give a man that is so selfish, so stubborn, so evil, so churlish in his ways, that you're going to offer. I'm telling you, if it had been me, I'd have sent judgment. I'd have said, hey, man, earthquake's coming, fire's coming down, lightning, I'm fixing to cast you off into hell. That's the way I'd have preached it. But the king said, you give him a message of peace. You tell him I want peace with him. I want peace with him. I want peace with his house. And peace be unto all thou hast. What an incredible message to give a terrible man. He said, and you tell him that kindness has been showed to him. You tell him that I'm the one that's helped him. You go tell him I've been a wall around everything that he has. You go tell him that all he has I've protected and kept, and the only reason he has it is because I've let nobody else come take it away from him. You go tell him that everything he's enjoying is because I've let him have it. So all of a sudden now, here's this terrible man. He gets this tender message. He gets this message, and the answer that he's going to respond to these messengers, it's going to mean something for his own future. It's going to mean something for his family. It's going to affect him throughout all eternity. What hope lies in the answer? What hope, what promise lies for his family? What success lies for his future? Because you just don't get a chance. You just don't get a message every day from the king. And you just don't get an opportunity to respond to that message every day. Nabal, you're never going to get another opportunity like this. Nabal, you're not going to get a chance like this. And Nabal looks at them messengers with all the potential of the blessings of his life upon him and his family now and forever. And he looks back at them messengers that have offered him peace, and he responds like this: who is David? Who is David? You don't know who David is? Here's another reason why I know David wasn't independent Baptist, because the Bible said he was the sweet psalmist of Israel. David, who is David? He's a man after God's own heart. David is the sweet psalmist of Israel. Say, what is a man after God's own heart? He's got the heart of God. Love, joy, peace, long-suffering, gentleness, goodness, faith, meekness, temperance. That's the heart of God. Judgment is his strange work. God, David had a heart that was after God. That's why he could send peace to this terrible man. Don't wreck your chance, Nabal. Don't wreck it. It's my life. I don't need David. Don't wreck your chance, Nabal. It's my life. I'm not going to help David. It's my shears. It's my water. It's my flesh. It's all mine. It's my life, and I'm not giving it to David. So you know what the messengers do? They said, all right, and they turn, and they go back to David. When they come back to David, they tell David what Nabal has said. Now, David is a sovereign king because the anointing oil is upon him. And if David's a sovereign king, cannot a king do anything that he wants? And you can't question what he decides to do? He's sovereign. Whatever he decides to do is beyond discussion. It's beyond debate. There's no sense in questioning it. He is a sovereign king. He can do anything he wants to at any time he wants to, whenever, whenever, whoever he wants to. He's a sovereign king. And so David looks back at the host that's behind him, and he looks at all those men, and here's what he says. Gird up every man your sword. Get your sword. Get upon your horse. In vain have I been kind to this man. I've been his friend. I've kept him alive. I've protected him. I've been a wall about him, and he has shown no gratitude. He has rejected me, and now evil is determined against Nabal, where once mercy was offered. You say it's not fair. What do you mean it's not fair? He's done offered him peace. He's done offered him everything in the world, and he's rejected it. He deserves it. Evil is determined upon him. Now, here comes David with a sword in his hand. He sent a sermon, but he's not coming with a sermon. He's done sent the sermon. So here he comes now with a sword. And he's got this sword in his hand, and determined evil is now coming with him. Destined wrath is fixing to come down upon Nabal. Destroying judgment is now coming beneath the hooves of those horses, and he's coming with a flaming sword, taking vengeance on them who know not God. And so all of a sudden, in the midst of all this judgment, and in the midst of all this determined evil that David is determined against Nabal, up steps Abigail. You talk about a good woman of understanding? She hears what's happened. She hears what message was brought to her husband. She hears what how Nabal has responded. And she knows now that David is coming with a sword. You see, this woman understood who David was. She knew he was a king with authority. She not only understood who David was, but she understood what David could do, and she understood what David was doing. And old Nabal, old ignorant, oblivious Nabal, he has no idea what he's done. He has no idea that by rejecting that message from them messengers, that judgment is now coming over the hilltop. And so there he is standing there in all of his stubbornness, all of his obnoxious evil ways, and totally oblivious that just over that hill, determined evil is coming with a sword in its hand. He don't even know what's fixing to hit him. Who is David? Can I say there's a side of David that you don't want to know? But there is a side of David that you do want to know. The sweet side of David, now that's the side of David everybody would like to meet. Everybody would love to enjoy the sweet side of David. Everybody would love to enjoy that heart that is after God. But there's a side of David that you don't want to meet. You don't want to meet the sword side. You don't want to meet the judgment side. You don't want to meet that authoritative side of the king. You don't want to meet him. And so Abigail goes out and saves her household. Abigail goes out, and actually what she does, she saves her husband. She saves the day. She goes out to meet him. She intercedes, sacrifices her life. She risked her life to bow down in the dirt with her face to the ground. And here's the picture. David is now marching with an army. with destruction and wrath, blood on his vesture, sword in his hand, and fire in his eyes. Here he comes. And Nabal is over here totally oblivious to what's coming. And right in the middle, between Nabal and judgment, between Nabal and the king, up steps Abigail, bows herself to the ground, her face is in the dirt, and the first words that come out of her mouth, my Lord, you see, Abigail knew who David was. Abigail knew that David was the Lord, the anointed king. She knew the sweet side. She knew the sword side. And so Abigail begins to plead for her husband. And it is worth every moment, it is worth reading her prayer to God for this crazy husband. It's worth going home and reading what she says to this king who has got nothing but judgment in his heart and a sword in his hand. Nabal, he deserves to be reproved. Nabal deserves judgment. Because David had been good to him, asked for very little, only asked for a little flesh, a little water, and a little bread. And Nabal is not going to give him nothing, even though the king has made sure that all that prosperity he gave him, he protected him, he kept him, and made sure that he had all that he had. Abigail says, "Oh, king, folly's with him. He's a fool." She's not hiding the fact. She's not trying to hide the fact before God. He's a fool. He doesn't know what he's done. He is ignorant. He don't judge him. Don't avenge him. Let him live. That's her plea. No evil, just mercy. There's more glory in saving him than there is judging him. That's what she's pleading. And old Nabal, I say again, Nabal had no idea what he had. He didn't realize what a good woman she was. He didn't realize how beautiful she really was. He didn't realize what a good woman she really was. He should have thanked God for her every day. Should have spent more time with her. You see, Nabal didn't realize how close he'd come to dying this day. When David was coming, he was coming to shed blood that day. He wasn't going to wait. He wasn't going to give him another message. He wasn't going to give him another reprieve. He wasn't going to give him another chance. He was coming to kill him that day. David, his vengeance and his wrath, thundering on them horses, and they all had their swords. They all had girded up their swords. And all of a sudden, that judgment, that whole army was stopped dead in his tracks because of a little woman in the dirt. She stops the whole judgment of God. She stops the whole army by herself. David was coming to kill him. David was coming to shed blood. And you talk about great mercy being shown. Here's what David said. Except thou hadst come to me, there would have been nothing left. And the time would come when David would reach out and realize what a good woman she was, and David would reach out and take that woman, put him up in her arms, up in his arms, marry her, and bring her in the palace. Can you imagine the sermon subjects that can be preached out of that story? Can you imagine how many sermons are written in that little story? There's a sermon you could preach on David as a despised fugitive, though crowned a king, that will one day sit upon the throne in Jerusalem. Isn't that a picture of the Lord Jesus? You see, this world has no idea what they're doing when they get rid of Jesus. They have no idea what they're doing when they say things that they say about him. They have no idea that one day, this Jesus, if they don't know who he is or what to do with him, they have no idea he is going to sit on the throne in Jerusalem one day. They have no idea. But he's coming back, and he's coming to rule. What a sermon. What a subject. There's another sermon. Nabal is this sinner that receives this tender message from the king. Isn't that a picture of the sinner? I mean, just as evil and evil as you can be. And the king sends a message of peace. Isn't that a picture of the gospel? Isn't that a picture of the preacher? the faithful messenger bringing a message of peace to a very evil man? What a sermon to preach. What a message can be preached. Then there's another sermon, the determined evil for rejecting the king. You see, Nabal had no idea what was coming. He had no idea that that sword and judgment was coming over the hilltop. Only because he rejected the message of the king. What a message of judgment to the poor sinner who walks out on the gospel and says, I don't need it, I don't want it, I won't give the church, I won't give God anything. What a sermon. David riding on that horse with the sword in his hand, if that's not a picture of Revelation 19, there's not one in the whole Bible. What a sermon. What an incredible message. Eyes, a flame of fire, white horse, vesture dipped in blood, the armies of heaven following him, and a sharp sword in his hand. That is a complete picture of Revelation chapter 19 hidden in the pages of the Old Testament. And all those subjects are great sermons. But that's not what I want to preach on. See, what do you want to preach on? I want to preach on Abigail. Say, who? Abigail? She's the church. Abigail's the church. You talk about a picture of the house of God, the church of God in this Old Testament. The presence of the church is like the presence of Abigail. In the midst of a rude, evil, obnoxious world, in the midst of all this selfishness and all this evil doings, the church's beauty still shines forth. You go up and down the highways of every city, and there is every institution of suffering, from hospitals to jails to prisons to rescue missions to mental insanities to orphan homes. But just keep driving, and eventually you're going to see a beautiful church in the midst of all the sufferings of our society. She's a light in darkness. That's what she is. You see, a storm come through a long time ago and blew out the power. And you know what happens when the power goes out? Everybody starts lighting candles. And when that storm come through our world and blew the power out, God lit a candle called the church. And her light still shines. And she still offers warmth to a poor sinner. She still offers light to come out of the darkness. She's alive, she's beautiful, and how the church has maintained her goodness in this evil world, can you imagine? Name me another institution that still stands after 2,000 years. Name me what government, name me what country is still as powerful. I'm telling you, in the midst of all the generations and the troubles and wars and fightings and killings and bloodshed that have marched on from generation to generation, the church still exists, her fire still lit, her light still shines like it has for the last 2,000 years. She's a strong woman. How she's been able to endure, anybody's guess. How she's been able to survive when Rome couldn't, when all the nations of the world have reached their pinnacles of power and wealth, and they've all crumbled in history, and how the church is able to just keep marching on, you can't even imagine. She has to be a strong woman. She has to be a good woman. She has to be a smart woman. She's got to be smart because she's still got a grip on the truth. Can you imagine for 2,000 years ago, she got a grip on the truth that Jesus Christ was the Son of God and that there's salvation and eternal life in Him, and she still got a grip on that truth. She's strong. She's smart. She's a survivor. Well, you see, the burdens of the world have been heavy on the back of the church. The weight of the world has rested on her shoulders. The ways of the world have been heavy about her back. The wars of the world have burdened her heart. And what the church has done, they've taken the burdens of the world and they've turned and they've bowed upon their knees and put their face in the dirt and they've pled before God. My Lord, she turns and looks towards God and she begs for more men Give me more men. She looks to God and she said, give me more messages. I want more messages. Would you give me more money? I need more money. I need more men. I need more members. But she doesn't plead for herself. She pleads for the world. She don't ask God to make. When Abigail went before David, she wasn't begging for herself. She wasn't begging for David to put wealth on her and to clothe her in garments of royalty and put a crown. That's not what she was begging for. She was begging for Nabal. And the church turns, and when we turn to God, what we're begging for is not for ourselves. But what we're begging for is what we need to help the Nabals of this world. And while Nabal is getting drunk and having a party, Abigail's out there on her face begging the king to save him. And while the world is out there tonight with all their parties and all their evils, we've gathered up in here for more grace, more knowledge, more power, not for us, but for them. So that we can have something to tell them. So that we can have the strength to be able to go to them. The world's just like old Nabal. You talk about unthankful. The church has done more for the world than they can even imagine. We've built our hospitals. We've built our orphans' homes. We've built rescue missions. We've given and gone, and they're still unthankful. I preach prison revivals in the state of Texas. And when you walk in that maximum security prison, all that barbed wire, and there's 5,000 of some of the most violent men that have ever been born in Texas, there's a sign there that says, no hostages will enter back through these gates. And what they're saying to us who risked our life to go in, that if anything happens when we're in that prison, if they take us hostage, they won't negotiate for our release. They won't negotiate for our life and our safety. We have given up our rights when we go in. You know what that means? The church risked her life to go in their prisons. And we don't ask for nothing. We don't ask for no money. We don't ask for no awards. We don't ask for nothing. We give that. We preach their funerals. We visit their hospitals. We go to their jails. We don't ask for nothing. And they're so unthankful. And they're so ungrateful. Because they still don't understand what the church is and what it's done, what it can do. She spends her time, her presence, in the midst of this world. She's a good woman with a beautiful countenance and good understanding. Then there's the power of the church. The power of the church is in the salvation that she offers. Here comes David with anger in his heart. Here comes David with vengeance on his mind. Here comes David with a sword in his hand. Here comes David with blood in his eyes. And this little woman, Abigail, stands up against the fierce wrath of the king, bows upon her face, and begins to plead with sympathetic words. And it stops the wrath of the king. And the king looks down at her and he said, blessed be thy advice. You kept me this day from coming to shed blood. You ever wondered why the world is allowed to go on and on in all of her evils? Have you ever wondered what keeps God from coming back and judging her? Have you ever wondered why the sinner is allowed to persist in his sins and just keep sinning and becomes more evil in his ways? Have you ever wondered just what keeps the anger of God back? Have you ever wondered what keeps wrath and judgment from coming? Can I tell you what it is? It's a little woman calls the church that still meets together, still bows upon her knees and pleads for her lost loved ones, pleads for her lost friends, pleads for her lost people. And as long as she pleads, God has a hard time handling the pleas of the church. They get to the heart of God. You know, everybody says we live in the days of Noah. And we do, don't we? Violence fills the land. The imagination of man's hearts is evil continually. And so everybody's preaching today, we're in Noah's day, and judgment is coming. But you know what they never preach? Do you know what Peter said about Noah's day? He said, in those days, God waited. If you look at the judgment side of God, he probably should have come back a long time ago. But if you look at the mercy side of God, he could wait another 100 years. If you've got loved ones and children that you've plead for, aren't you glad the Lord hadn't come back? And as long, when the church quits pleading for the sinner, and all she wants is to heap the wealth of this world upon her, God, when she quits pleading, he'll come back. But I'm telling you, as long as she pleads, the plea of that little woman breaks the heart of God. The church ever gives up on the sinner? You see, it's not until the church is gone before he'll even come back. He can't come back as long as that little woman's in his way. He loves her too much. Her pleas are too strong. If little Abigail can stop the wrath of the king, what do you think the church does before God? You want an illustration? You want a biblical illustration of what power the church has in prayer and pleading? Peter's put in prison over in Acts chapter 12. He's put in prison, and they put him in this cell, and they put chains on him. Not only do they put him in that cell, not only do they put chains on him, but they lock the door, and then there's a quadrant. There's four guards before the door. Now, that's what you call being locked down. How in the world could you get out of a cell that you've got chains on, the door's locked, and there's four guards in front of it? It's impossible to get out. And all of a sudden, the chains snap off, the door swings open, the guards go to sleep, and Peter walks out. See, how does he become free? Because the church is praying without ceasing. Amen. That's how Peter got out. That's the illustration that God gives us in the Bible, how much power the church has got in prayer. But the church has forgotten that today. She doesn't even realize what kind of power she has when it comes to praying before her God. I've got an article on my desk, come out of the Houston Chronicle. There was a mother by the name of Mary Jane Cotter, C-O-D-E-R. She had three daughters. She had a daughter, 6-year-old, named Megan. She had a daughter named Dallas, that's 8 years old, and a girl named Jessica that's 9 years old. And this mama took these three girls, and she went down to Big Bend National Park to go on a nature hiking trail. So she's got her three girls, and she's going through the river, the Rio Grande, and she's going through the beautiful mountains and the sandy sides and all the beauty. And this mama comes upon this beautiful rock, and behind it is this mountain, and she thinks, what a great backdrop for a picture. So she takes her three girls and sits them on this rock, and she backs up with her digital camera, and she's fixing to take a picture of her three girls standing on that beautiful colored rock with that big mountain behind her. And in that camera, she sees a mountain lion come behind them girls onto that rock. That mother, according to the article, and I've got it, that mother, she ran over there. She grabbed them three girls, threw them down at the base of that rock. She reached in her little pouch, and all she had was a 2-inch knife. And that mama took that 2-inch knife and started towards that lion. She got in between her and her three little girls with a little 2-inch file knife and started. And she got so close to that lion that lion reached out and slapped her arm and tore that flesh and knocked that knife out. And she screamed and the lion ran off. Them gals got a mama, don't they? Can I tell you why the church takes the beating and the sinner don't? Because the church gets in between the sinner and Satan, and she turns with her knife in her hand, and the devil has tore at the church and ripped at the church and lied about the church and tried to destroy the church. And all she's done is try to stand in between the sinner and Satan to keep him from destroying him. That's why the church takes the beating. That's why the church takes all the abuse. Because she's trying to help a poor sinner. I've looked at the presence of the church and the power of the church, and let me look at the prayers of the church. Abigail's prayer wasn't for herself. Remember what she said? Upon me. Don't hurt Nabal. That's what she's begging for. Do it to me. Don't hurt him. Hurt me. Let that iniquity be upon me. Undeserving, unthankful, ungrateful Nabal, foolish, churlish in his ways, evil in his doings, worthy of death. And Abigail's prayers take the sword out of David's hand. Takes the anger out of David's heart, and he doesn't die for 10 days. David was coming to kill him that day. Blessed be thy advice, I was coming to shed blood today. But he doesn't die for 10 days. You know what that means? He got 10 more chances. As undeserving as he was. And have you ever prayed for those friends and family and loved ones? And you wonder why they keep going on and on and on. And you know why they keep surviving, going through what they go through? They should have been dead a long time ago. But the reason why they survive is because somebody is pleading before God. And those prayers have touched the heart. Nabal didn't die for 10 days. Every day, Nabal in his heart would say, I don't want you, David. I'm not giving you nothing. And God would wait another day and gave him 10 more chances. I say again that you and I don't even realize how powerful the prayers of the church really are. I joined Shady Acres Baptist Church in January of 1979. I've been a member there for 28 years. We've had a Saturday night prayer meeting ever since I've joined. I was there last night for prayer meeting. When I'm in town, unless I'm dogged out, I'm always at prayer meeting. You can't imagine what I have seen in 28 years. You can't imagine what I've heard in 28 years. Women have gathered up on them Saturday nights to pray. I've seen children brought out of the worst conditions. I've seen families come through the worst conditions. I have seen miracle after miracle with my own family. I've seen it all because the church is met to pray. There's an example. There was a man here just about a year and a half ago, maybe 2 years ago. He drove by our church back and forth for several years. And he lived out in our subdivision. But when he'd drive by, he'd always look at the church, but he'd never come in. Well, one day, 57 years old, he gets an inkling to come into church. Well, he comes in the church and he sits down, and you know how us independents are. I mean, old Brother Danny, you know, he's up there preaching, you know, and he's probably got everybody in hell, and you know, he's cutting everybody's head off, and that's just the way we do it. And old Mr. Payne gets up and walks out, and he said, I will never come back to this church as long as I live. He come back the next Sunday. He come in and he sat down, and old Brother Danny got up and began to preach that old gospel again. And in the middle of the sermon, Mr. Payne gets up, walks out into the lobby, and he's pacing back and forth in the lobby, and he said, I will never go back into that church again. And he comes back in and he sits down. He comes Sunday after Sunday after Sunday, and on Saturday nights, when us men would go down there to pray, somebody would say, pray for Mr. Payne. Pray for Mr. Payne. 57 years old, been a drug addict half of his life, got 2 teenage girls. Pray for Mr. Payne. And the Sunday came when Mr. Payne got up and walked down that aisle and got saved. His wife said, I've never seen him change so in all my life. Mr. Payne got in church, and 3 months after he got saved, he had had hepatitis C for years. And all of a sudden, it broke loose and began to destroy and eat up all of his liver and his kidneys. And they put him in a hospital. He got out, and he just began to just dry up, and he just turned into a skeleton. And just a few days before he died on a Sunday, he told his daughters, he said, take me to church. And my wife and I was in church on that Sunday, fixing to leave on the Monday to go head off to a meeting. And I looked over there, and there Mr. Payne sat in a wheelchair in the middle of the aisle. He looked like a skeleton. And I walked over there and I sat down beside him, and I said, Mr. Payne, I'll see you again. And the old man looked at me and he said, oh yeah, I'll see you again. He died a few days later. But you say, how does a man like that get saved? Late in life? How does a man get saved like that who's destroyed part of his life with drugs? You know how he gets saved? On Saturday nights when we come to prayer meeting, we all have little pieces of paper, and everybody says, pray for my son, pray for my daughter, pray for my neighbor, pray for somebody that I work with. Somebody would say, pray for Mr. Payne. And so on these little pieces of paper are all these burdens. And so we divide up one group goes in one corner, and we got four different groups in four different corners, and we're all over there taking turns praying off this little list. And so after Mr. Payne got saved and died, I'd go home, and all them little pieces of paper were on my desk, and I got to going through them, and for months, the church was saying, pray for Mr. Payne, and it was written on them little pieces of paper. How does a man like that get saved? The church prays. That's how that man gets saved. The church prays. Underneath the glass on my study desk is little prayer cards. The ladies in the church through the years would pray, and at the end of the month, they would send these prayer cards to the people that they prayed for to let them know who was praying on for them on a certain day. If you was to stand there right now and look down at my desk, there's a little prayer card that says, Teresa Smith prayed for me on 610-01. Barbara Daugherty prayed for me on 70101. Dolores Tadlock prayed for me on 9901. Pat Couch prayed for me 10-05-01. Lillian Walsham prayed for me 5-12-01. Lila Clintz prayed for me 6-28-01. Nancy Wilson prayed for me 3-8-05. Laura Beth Wright prayed for me 7-21-05. Betty Ferrara prayed for me on 3-21-05. Teresa Rankin prayed for me 2-13-05. Diane Timmy prayed for me 10-27-05. Can I tell you today where these women are at? Teresa Smith is now in heaven. Barbara Daugherty's in a nursing home and can't pick her head up off her chest. Dolores Tadlock is too old to come to church, and she's having hip replacements, and they're having to take care of her at home. Pat Couch has Alzheimer's disease. Lillian Walson is approaching 80 years old. Lila Clintz is over 80 years old. Nancy Wilson has lung cancer. Laura Beth Wright cannot even stand up in the song service anymore because her legs are too weak. Betty Ferrara's in a wheelchair. Teresa Rankin, I can't even tell you what she's been through with them four children. Diane Timmy was the lady in our church that accidentally ran over that boy last week and killed that little two-year-old boy of our song leader. And I look down at those names, and I look at the condition and where them women are at, and I'm saying, who's ever going to pray for me? When they're all dead and gone, who's going to send me a prayer card telling me on 7-13-01, 07, who's going to pray for me? Who's going to gather up today to pray and send somebody a card saying, I prayed for you? Can I show you something? Would you look in Ephesians chapter 6? Can I show you something incredible? I want you to look in the 6th chapter of the book of Ephesians. The Apostle Paul is in the worst situation he's ever been in his life. Paul's in prison. He's in a dark Roman cell. And he's looking back at the church in Ephesus, and he says in verse 18, praying always with all prayer and supplication in the Spirit, and watching thereunto with all the perseverance and supplication for all the saints. He's saying, church, would you just pray? Would you pray for me? Look at the next three words. And for me. When you pray, don't forget me. We're talking about the Apostle Paul, the writer of the Bible, caught up into the third heaven. And he's saying, church, pray always. And when you pray for the saints, would you just pray for me? And if you knew the power of the prayers of the church, before we ever dismiss tonight, you would stand and you would say, "Church, would you just remember me? Would you pray for me?" Church has lost sight of just how powerful her prayers are before God. They used to write books on the things that the church did with prayers alone. The rest of the story, you know what happens to Abigail? Oh, she gets married. She marries the king, comes in the palace. But then she gets captured by the Amalekites. And they take her, and they take her, and they put her in her camp. And the king comes back and finds her missing. He said, "I'm going after my bride." And he goes and rescues her. You know the picture behind that? You hear people preach today, and they'll tell you everything is wrong with the church. They'll tell you that she's not dressing right, and she's not doing right, and she's not doing this, she's not doing that. Can I tell you, God knows where she's at. God knows what she's going through. This king knew where Abigail was when the Amalekites had. He knew when to go capture her. He knew how to get her out of that camp. He knew how. Just because she was in that camp with Amalekites didn't mean she was no longer married to David. He was still her husband. He knew how and he knew when. And you can find everything wrong with the church. God knows what she needs, where she's at, and he knows how to get her attention. Piano player, if you'll come. I'm a 19-year-old boy on May the 26th, 1967. And at that time, I had my last date with my little lovely wife. And I looked at her on that day of May in 1967, and I said, "I'm leaving." But I said, "One of these days, I'm going to come back and marry you." And I left. My life went one way, her life went the other. But 37 years later, I came back and I married her. And if a North Texas country boy can give a promise and come back after all them years, you don't think that God, who hasn't given us a promise, he said, "I'll be back." And he will. He's king. He'll come back for his bride when he's ready. You be praying when he comes. As she plays, would you bow your heads?